circle court. An equity lawsuit is when you were trying to get the judge to issue some type of legal proclamation in your favor, such as you've acquired your neighbor's property by adverse possession, or if your neighbor is ordered to cut down a street, or something like that, and you're not suing for money damages. What are called equitable lawsuits. And that developed at common law. In fact, as I said last time, at common law, we have separate courts just for equitable actions called courts of chancery, and they were called chancery instead of judges. All that nonsense from England that we inherited. Michigan got rid of that in 1963. But the equitable defenses still apply. A defense means that you're being sued for an equitable action. You can win the suit if you can establish this. And we're going to have defenses to tort actions, and we're going to have defenses to contract actions, and we're going to be talking about those as we go along. Latches and unclean hands are the two recognized equitable defenses. Latches sounds like a disease, doesn't it? Bugs, bed bugs are called on or something. Latches means that the plaintiff waited too long to file the lawsuit. If it helps you to remember, latches is equity's statute of limitations, if you want to use it. Think about it that way. In a legal cause of action, such as breach of contract where you're suing for money damages, there's a statute of limitations that says you can only do that for 6 years. Equity has no specific period. Latches just because in equity, the judge has broad discretion to issue any type of order that is fair and equitable to both parties. And so, if the plaintiff waited too, and I'll give you an example here in a minute, if the plaintiff waited too long to file the lawsuit, he can lose, even if he had filed it a year or two before, he might have won, but it's no, it might have been fair at one time to give him the relief he sought, but it's no longer fair. For example, you believe that your neighbor was building his building, encroaching on your property line, just as the foundation was being poured. You knew that. He apparently was mistaken. You sit back and wait until the building is halfway built, almost, in fact, beyond that, almost all the way built, because you want to stick it to the guy for doing that. And then you run into circuit court and file a complaint for equity for what's called a specific, an equitable judgment from the court ordering this person to cease and desist. In fact, more than cease and desist, tear the thing down because he's encroaching on your property line. Had you gone into the court of equity just when he was starting, you would have got your order, no problem. But by sitting back and waiting until this person put all kinds of more money into this building, it's no longer fair to expect them to tear that down. That's an example of the equitable defense of latches.
The reason why I'm confused is because actually one of my neighbors, not to my family, but to another one of our neighbors, that had this little tiny, tiny house and a huge lot on the whole, on the actual lake. So he split the lot in two, kept the lot with his house to him, put up the other one. And a guy from Detroit moved in and built a three-story house. And when the house was completely done, the guy took the other guy to court. And for years, he equity sued because he couldn't see out of his bedroom window anymore at the lake because the guy built this huge house.
Right. Maybe it was because it was blocking his natural sunlight, so he couldn't grow flowers or anything. Something like that's probably a better example than a boundary line encroachment.
Well, like the one that's like, as far as I know, that was the only reason why he sued is because he could no longer see lake out of two of his windows out of his house. He could only see it out the front of his house. So, and he won.
When we get to damages and contract actions, which is many, many chapters from now, we're going to come back to that. But just because this, we were talking about the court system last week, we wanted to get, wanted at least give you some idea of this. Again, I want to wait here. Mike.
What if you're on vacation and then you come back and it's like halfway built? Would that change it?
What's that?
Like, say if you went on vacation and you come back and it's like halfway built, will it change the law that way?
That's a long vacation. You know, it just depends on how you develop the facts. If you didn't have any reason to believe there was a violation of your property rights before you filed the lawsuit, then it's not latches. Latches is just a remedy designed to prevent people from playing games and coming into court way a long time after they should have to deal with the problem before it gets a whole lot worse. Unclean hands comes from a famous case in England called the Highwayman's case. Nothing to do with the old folk group called the Highwayman. Any of you are in the old folk group, like I am. Unclean hands means the plaintiff is coming into a court of equity and trying to get an equitable judgment is themselves engaging in underhanded tactics, bad faith, and maybe even doing the same thing they're accusing the defendant of doing. Maybe they're accusing the defendant of dumping on their side of the property, or they're accusing the defendant of chopping down branches that are hanging over, but they really aren't hanging over, but they think they are, so they just went ahead and trespassed and chopped them down. But maybe the plaintiff is doing the same thing. Unclean hands. You lose. Unclean hands or latches, the defendant can win the equity lawsuit. We'll come back to this in more detail when we're at the end of contracts and when we're into remedies and damages and all that sort of thing. All right. Ready for torts. A lot of torts we're going to be talking about tonight. Tort law develops, as I said last time, as did contract law, from hundreds of years of case law history from English common law, from many decisions in England that evolved over time. Torts are comprised of component parts called elements. This is the closest I come in this class to teaching criminal law, because criminal law is the same thing. The crimes are comprised of component parts. And the best way to learn it is to learn what the component parts are, and then you know the tort. It's the plaintiff's responsibility of filing a lawsuit claiming that a tort has been committed against them to prove each of these elements. But unlike criminal law, a standard of proof is, as I said last time, only preponderance, and you can think of it in terms of majority of the evidence. So you have to prove that each element occurred with more evidence than the defendant can establish to show that it didn't occur. So the legal term that they use, the cases use, is preponderance. But think of it in terms of majority. That's all you've got to think of. And if you want a test, say a majority of the evidence, then I'll know what that this is what you're talking about. I'm not going to nitpick you on that. Assault is where I usually start with intentional torts. This first classification and group of torts are all intentional torts, and I keep putting intentional in there as one of the elements. But they're all, until we get to negligence, all of these are what we call intentional torts, which means that the plaintiff always has to have the intent to achieve this particular result. We're not talking about accidental stuff here. Accidental stuff is negligence. Those are unintentional torts. We'll get to that tonight, too. So these are all intentional acts. But habits are hard to break. And this is the way I always do them. So I always put intentional in there. Maybe just to pound home the fact that it has to be proven that plaintiff had this intent. So the first one is assault. Now, people use these terms, assault and battery, together as if they're one and the same. They're not. Not in civil law, anyway. In civil law, they're separate. And it's kind of neat to understand this, because if you're the victim of an assault and the prosecutor chooses not to prosecute, or it's like in Saginaw, you can't get the police to do anything because they're too busy, you can go ahead and sue the person for doing that to you. So if the police and the prosecutor don't want to take the case, you can sue them. Sometimes they don't take the case because of shoddy investigation or incompetence, or they think you're lying, or whatever the case may be, they just don't take it, or they're too busy, or whatever. You can sue them for this. The exact same elements in the civil tort as are in the criminal offense. Now, some assaults are called domestic violence, and they have additional elements, such as the victim has to be a member of the same household or have a child in common, some of that other stuff. We're not dealing with that here. Just the basic elements of assault, which is an intentional act placing one in fear of either one or another. This is either or down here. Either imminent bodily harm or imminent offensive bodily contact. Either way. So you either think you're going to be physically injured by this person, or you think you're just going to have offensive bodily contact that you don't want. And of course, offensive bodily contact is battery. A lot of people are surprised to learn that no touching is necessary for an assault. No touching is necessary for an assault. An assault is a victim being placed in fear of what's going to happen right now. So, I'm going to put this to you. You're assaulted because you don't know whether I'm going to miss or not. You know, I might miss and I might not. You don't know. You might be intending to block the punch. I mean, you're not going to consent to it. People can consent to punches. We'll get more into that later. But for purposes of learning what the Torah is right now. So whether it is just someone's about to, ooh, he's going to touch my skin. Ah, that dirty, filthy person. That, if you experience the fear that that's about to happen, that's an assault, because that's the offense of bodily contact, or if you think you're actually going to be physically injured, like that bullet's coming your way, or that baseball bat, or that knife, or that fist, or that open hand with a slap that you think might cause you to bleed, whatever the case may be, that's an assault. Now, an important doctrine for assault is the doctrine of transferred intent. Transferred intent. Because I have two guys sitting together. Can't do this for lady victims, I just don't do that. My last two guys back here. Alright. I'm approaching these two guys right here. I love that. Say, I love this guy. This guy's my best friend, Mike here. I hate this guy. I raise my fist and I take a swing at him. But he ducks. And I get Mike. Remember, this is an intentional torque. I have to have intent. How many assaults just occurred?
Two.
One.
Who says two? Yes, because of the doctrine of transferred intent, Mike. Not bad. You have to have some kind of bending of these rules a little bit to protect victims. So even though I didn't have any intent as to Mike, because Mike experienced the fear of the fist coming his way, he's going to solve it because of his doctrine of transferred intent.
So
there's also a battery as to him, too, by the way. So he could sue me for two counts, assault and battery. And Casey could only sue me for one count of assault. Does somebody have a...
Yeah. So just because, like, there's only one assault happening when you swing at the person you're aiming for and you miss and hit somebody else?
My intent to place Casey in fear of imminent bodily harm or imminent offense or bodily contact transferred to Robert because of the reckless way in which I was carrying out my intent. Because another human being was so close to him.
But the person you missed could still turn around and sue you for assault, though.
What's that?
The person that you missed could still sue you or get in trouble.
He could sue me for assault. Now, again, a lawsuit has two component parts to it, liability and damages. Liability can be the easy part. Damages, not so easy. He'd have to prove that somehow he has damages. Oh, I can't sleep at night, Your Honor. I have this fear of Mr. Dunn's fist coming toward me. And I just can't now. I had this terrible fear of coming to his next class and accidentally running into his fist. And so I need to go to a psychologist and deal with this issue right there. Okay. Damages, and we'll talk a whole lot more about damages later. I mean, there's damages for tort actions and damages for contract actions, but to save time, and rather than repeat the whole thing twice, I do damages when we get past contracts. But if he can't prove that he was harmed in any way, then it's no harm, no foul, like the touching in basketball, as the guards coming down the court. It's no harm, no foul. You can't prove your damages.
Just because of transfer intent.
Damages is how your life was affected adversely by this action. I'm sorry,
No, I'm just trying to figure this out.
Your name, I'm going to remember fast here. Lawrence, that's the kind of student I like. You ask a lot of questions. I like that. All right. So no question about transfer intent?
I do have one, actually. What if you carried that further and you intended to kill somebody. You wanted to hit him with a baseball bat and just wipe him out. But you missed. What then? Is it just still...
If there's another human being in the vicinity that reasonably feared being struck with the bat based upon how you were handling and swinging the bat, then transfer intent.
Yeah, not the second person anymore. I'm still talking about the first person. You intended to kill that guy. You swung at him.
That's an assault. Assault. Battery is something different. Assault is placing a person in fear that it's going to happen. The victim doesn't know he's going to miss.
Right.
Yeah, the victim doesn't know he's going to miss. In any on battery, any touching that you don't want is offensive. Even if it's the kind of touching that I might like, this is a very subjective thing. If somebody else doesn't want it, it's a battery. If you're intending to touch them against their will, it's battery.
So do parents have to worry about this then?
What's that?
Do parents really have to worry about this? Is there a fine line then that now everybody getting involved with family?
Yeah, we're going to talk about sports and all that here shortly, about consent and all that aspect.
No, I mean like if you're getting a whooping, you're not, you know, hey, give me a whooping, daddy. You know, is
that yeah, we're going to get to that real quickly. There, it's a very good point you brought up. Give you a question. A lady is in her motel room sleeping. Some guy comes in the motel room, plants a kiss on her, and walks out the door. She slept, never awakened. Is that a battery or not a battery?
Wouldn't it be, like, technically she still wouldn't want that guy kissed?
And then tell me whether it was an assault or not an assault. What's that?
Technically, if the person doesn't want that person,
of course she didn't.
Wasn't
anybody she knew? Of course she didn't want it.
It should be battery, but not assault. Should be battery, but not assault.
Exactly. There was still an intentional touching that he knew would cause her offense, and it was without her consent. But she didn't experience it, so it's not an assault. Now, tort law developed along the line. Actually, tort law developed before criminal law. Now we're getting to the point you raised. And tort law started first. You had a chance to vindicate the violation of your rights with the king's representative in the community, and you could seek money damages because of some bad thing somebody did to you. They violated your peace and dignity, so to speak. But some things have more than one victim. A public beating in the street, or a breaking and entering into somebody's house, which leads to a conversion, like one of our intentional torts. Everybody is a victim in the neighborhood, because everybody has fear of it happening to them next, and is no longer safe. And so somebody needs to step forward and speak for them. And that's where the prosecutor comes in. And that's where the harm is such that we have criminal sanctions. It's more than just filing a civil suit, and we have a system of criminal laws. And so since everybody else in that situation is a victim, the victim themselves can't say, oh, no, I consent. It's okay. No, because that domestic violence, let's say, that yelling and screaming, and the person had to listen to the lady, no, don't, please stop, and then all of a sudden you hear this smacking going on. People next door are scared, and they're victims too. So they have a right that not be consented to. So your point is that sometimes it could be a crime and not a tort. If you really want to consent, that negates the tort, but it doesn't negate the crime that simultaneously occurs when the beating takes place. Now, for sports activity, everybody that plays a particular sport is experienced. They know what that, you mentioned the term fine line, that's a good way to put it, what that fine line is to cross over between consent and tort or crime. In hockey, which is my sport I like the best, my son's a pretty good hockey player, they all know that a hard check to the boards, being slammed into the boards, is consented to when the players go out on the ice. That's part of the game. baseball had a hard slide into the catcher at the plate. That's all it said. A hard slide at second base to take that second baseman out of the play so he can't make a double play. That's all considered consent. That hard foul in basketball when that guy is going for a breakaway layup that will tie the game in the last second, so he gets hammered and knocked down because the defensive player knows he can't shoot free throws very well. That's all consensual. But when, and I hate to bring this up because this was Todd Bertuzzi, who's a member of the Detroit Red Wings, although he was not a member of the Red Wings when this happened. But when Todd Bertuzzi comes from behind for a player much smaller than him at the time, Steve Moore of the Colorado Avalanche, and grabs him, and Bertuzzi's a big guy, and slams his head hard into the ice, the guy, I can carry you away. That's your turn. Now that guy is seriously injured, he's never going to play hockey again. That's crossing the line. Bertuzzi committed tort, and Bertuzzi probably committed a criminal offense. When another guy, Marty McSorley, the last game he ever played as a hockey player, came up from behind Donald Brashear in a hockey game about 10 years ago, two-handed stick, and he used his hockey stick as if it was a hammer, and smashed him like this, like a baseball bat to the side of the head, and got him in the temple and knocked him out cold. That's not consented to. That's crossing the line. And so the athletes and the coaches in particular sports know what that line is. And when they cross it, they can face civil tort and they can face a criminal prosecution. Now another thing about assault to keep in mind, assault's interesting because it has a subjective and an objective part to it. The objective part is imminent fear of imminent bodily harm or imminent offensive bodily contact has to be reasonably perceived by the victim. Okay? So it's got to be, he has to be reasonably capable of doing this.
So if somebody's in
the field. Okay, so we're not talking about a threat from way down the road or some sort of vague reference or I'm going to get you when I see you. Well, there's threats. But the threat there is some unspecified date in the future we're going to do the harm. Not, it's going to happen right now. For an assault, it's got to be, that's why the word imminent is in there. I put it in there twice. The fear is it's going to happen right now, within a second or so. And if the defendant who's being sued could not have done that within a few seconds, it was not physically possible, it's not an assault, it's just a future threat. Any question about any of that?
Well, what would you said about the sports one, but say the kid throws, breaks all the stuff in your, china cabinet and you give him a spanking. Does that fall under all that? Because the kid's not going to
give your kid a spanking?
Yeah. Say he tips over the cabinet chair and it's purpose and
We're living in a new era now. You give your kid a spanking and that's probably fourth degree child abuse under Michigan's criminal code.
Really?
Not a good idea. Not a good idea to spank your kids. Someone somewhere along the line is going to try to have you arrested for that. I don't recommend it. Give your kid consequences. Lots of consequences. Deprive them of stuff. I don't recommend spanking. Definitely not. Okay. Let's talk about defenses. Self-defense to the defense of others. Obviously, you have a right to self-defense. Self-preservation is the first law of nature. Law recognizes two types of force, non-deadly and deadly. The person coming at you with non-deadly force, you're only privileged to use non-deadly force to stop them. If the person's coming at you with deadly force, then you're privileged to use deadly force before they use their deadly force to stop them. And whether it's deadly or non-deadly depends on the facts. In any lawsuit, in fact, in any criminal case, it's the development of the facts. You got to develop the facts, right? The more facts you get, And just like in these problems after the chapters, the more facts you have, the easier it is for you to apply these rules that we're going to be learning tonight to particular factual scenarios. So, how big was this person? How big was the victim? What were the weapons involved, if there were weapons? Was one very intoxicated and the other not very intoxicated? You got to develop those facts, and then, with the development of those facts, then it's easy, maybe not easy, but certainly a lot easier, to apply these rules and decide whether the force was non-deadly or deadly. Now, I always like to use my example of a little old lady and Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't know why I ever came up with that. It was long before he became governor of California. Arnold Schwarzenegger comes at a little old lady. That's not equal force, obviously not. She would be privileged to defend herself from Arnold Schwarzenegger, at least with a .22 caliber. Maybe not a much bigger gun, but at least with that. That's what that person would need under those facts and circumstances to reasonably defend herself, because one blow, if he was going to punch her from a guy that big and strong, could do serious bodily harm or kill her. So to her, that was proper force. So you really need to know the facts before you really can answer. That's why I have a bar fight case on my criminal law final exam. I love bar fights. My favorite case to defend is a bar fight case. Juries think that you go into some of those bars, you deserve what you get. Don't come in here and try to prosecute somebody. You shouldn't have been in there. And juries think that way. That's why I love bar fight cases. And so in the characters that I have in the bar fight case, I describe the height and weight of each one of them and whether any of them had anything in their hands. It's easier to apply these rules. Defense of others is the same thing, same principle. You're privileged to come upon somebody else that's being attacked and use non-deadly force to stop that attack, or if it was deadly force, to use deadly force to stop that attack. We had a few other rules. Until recently in Michigan, we had a duty to retreat rule, except when you're on your own property. That if you encounter somebody in public that wants to start a fight with you, you have a duty to retreat, if you could retreat safely under the facts and circumstances. Like you have a bar, and you have the front and the back entrance, and there's cars parked by both the front and the back entrance. The guy that's been looking for you comes through the back entrance, and you're by the front entrance, and your car is parked just a few feet outside the front entrance. There's a whole bunch of people in the bar he's got to get through to get to you. You could easily get into your car and drive off.
But what if
you had a duty, a common law to do that. And the purpose of that is a public policy rule to try to encourage people not to engage in public assault and confrontations. Michigan has eliminated that. Yeah, that's like a Texas rule. Texas has all kinds of wild stuff. You can ride around a car with a gun in your lap in Texas. Can't do that in Michigan. So Michigan's eliminated that. And the other rule is another public policy rule, to stop people from being bullies. If you're the one that started the fight, you can't assert self-defense. You can't assert. That's right, Mr. Dunn. I did start it, but I started a non-deadly force attack. And this guy comes at me with deadly force. Nope. You started it, you cannot assert self-defense. You started it, you take the risk of whatever's going to happen. Somebody had a hand in it.
Well, going back to the one thing that Michigan got rid of, before they got rid of it, like, if the person's been drinking inside the bar, then what do you do?
You can now stand your ground in Michigan. Michigan's eliminated that. So, you can't become the aggressor. I mean, that's not a good point. But you can stand your ground and use whatever force is reasonably necessary, whether it's non-deadly or deadly, depends on the facts, to stop that attack against you. Any other questions about assault or battery? Hold on a second. You're right behind Mike. Collins.
This is continuing to carry, though, for somebody assaults you. Shouldn't you just assume that they're coming at you with an attempt to do deadly force?
Again, it's the development of the facts. Okay. Yes, the location where you are can make a difference. If you're in a very dangerous part of town or whether you are in church on Sunday morning can make a huge difference.
What if you were sitting, let's say you were sitting down at a park, and that same old lady comes up to you because she mistakes you for someone else. And she has her purse, and that purse is something heavy. She swings it at you, you do not think twice. You've just been assaulted during the days, and then you strike back. Well, you striking back because
you're only privileged to strike back. It's not, you don't have a right to trade one punch for another. Ain't no such rule. Some people used to think that it used to be one free dog bite before you could sue. In other words, that got started. It's not. You're only privileged to use force when the attack is ongoing. As soon as that person stops, shows no indication of continuing, you're not privileged to strike down. Oh, you got me? I can get your back. No. Only in a defensive posture can you strike somebody. Okay, so again, as long as you can articulate later why you thought that person was about to strike you again, then it's up to a jury to decide whether that was reasonable or not. Like I had a case, well, that's a case we're going to be doing in here, so I better not do it with the facts of that. We do have a case that we're going to be doing in here, a case that I handled that involved that kind of a situation. Where the guy's going to say, he thought, based on the way he was moving, he thought the guy was about to throw a punch and he hit, so he threw a punch. So then that becomes a jury question whether that's reasonable or not.
All right, so the one thing you said, so like, but how the one person, if you started it, but like, isn't that such a fine line who starts the fight? Because
yes,
I can go like
right.
Whatever, and turn around. And
factual development, investigation. Okay? Which side investigates the case better usually is the one that wins.
Because like, you know.
And as soon as it looks like there's going to be a lawsuit, what's the first thing that insurance company is going to do? They're going to get a PI out there to interview everybody.
Because, you know, like, what
and if. Try to nail everybody's story down in a way that's going to help the insurance company. Just like when I'm defending a criminal case, the first thing I do is I want to have everybody interviewed. I'm not going to rely on what's in that police report. But one thing, people almost never say the same thing twice.
So, like, if some guy says, oh, that guy slept with my girlfriend, even though the girlfriend consented to sleeping with each other and the relationship's over, so who's actually, like, in that case, start a fight? Because in the one person's view, that's, like, not, like...
The reason for it is irrelevant, really. That doesn't make any difference.
Is it, like, whoever throws, like, the first punch or... words or
again, it's very simple. You're only entitled to strike somebody if that person is about to strike you or about to strike somebody else. Then you can defend that person and you can defend yourself.
Alright.
Sure. Yeah, I gotta enforce myself. So Anthem.
Yeah. Hey, so what if someone comes at you and
you say, go ahead. I kind of like it when you place me in fear of imminent bodily armor, imminent bodily contact. You can do nothing and they strike you, you're a victim. There's nothing... No, I mean, you can either sue them or you can have them criminally prosecuted. The prosecutor refuses to bring the case to them.
Well, you don't have to
do anything if you don't want to. What do we have to do? Die in the attack.
But as far as the two different, if it's a criminal, if you sue the person, or if you have press criminal charges on them, that's separate than...
And you can do both at the same time.
You do both at the same
time. So in criminal law, you are entitled to restitution, but that's only your out-of-pocket losses. Damages in civil court go beyond out-of-pocket losses. Pain, suffering, humiliation, embarrassment. I can't go out anymore. I can't go to a restaurant that serves alcohol anymore because every time I do, I remember getting attacked in that one place I was at. So, your life has been changed. Your life has been altered because of what somebody else did to you. Those are damages, civil damages. Okay. I'm ready to go to false imprisonment. We got a lot of ground to cover tonight. If you got any questions about this or pops in your head, we can come back to you. Okay.
All right, I got one more.
Mr. Lawrence Henry, or is it Mr. Henry Lawrence?
Lawrence Henry. I actually wrestled a guy in high school that had the same exact name, just backwards. But
did you?
Yeah. But anyways, like, so as far as a strike, what's classified as a strike? Does that mean, like, push anything like that?
Depends on the development of the facts. If you thought that person was just about to shove you, you could shove them first.
So, like, if a person's right here and through my face and I put my hands on them, push them back gently?
It depends on how close they are. You're entitled to some personal space. If it's like nose to nose, then who moved up to the other person? If it was them that moved to you, yeah, you could push them back a little bit. You'd be okay.
Like, you know, like you said,
if you went to them, and then you pushed them.
Yeah,
because you went to them.
That's what I thought. I'm talking, like, if I'm leaning up against the bar and I turn around, the guy is right there.
If he's like nose, I mean, literally nose, it's touching practically. You can smell the garlic on his breath from the dinner that he ate. Yeah, you could shove him a little bit. Could you punch him 3 times on the field? No. But again, what's reasonable to deal with the situation? False imprisonment, pretty easy one. Intentionally confining another within closed space. Right? If the person, as far as a defense to this, if a person had a reasonable and safe means of escape, but simply chose not to, said, oh, I know what the elements of false imprisonment are, because I had Mr. Dunn's class. I'm just going to stay right here. Yeah, I could escape. He forgot that window was open, and I could get out of here, but I'm going to stay right here, because I want to sue that person for false imprisonment. No. No. Because if you're not escaping when you could have, then what are you doing? Dig into the sea. Consenting. And if you want to consent, oh, go ahead. I just love it when you lock the door and keep me in here. If you want to do that, you can do that. No law that says you can't do that.
So if spanking your children has become battery, when does grounding them become false imprisonment?
No, it isn't false imprisonment because you have a legal duty to control your children and use reasonable discipline until they're of age. So that's never false imprisonment.
But only because grounding them is considered reasonable today.
Right.
Because spanking was considered reasonable
now,
previously.
Now, if you didn't have any custodial rights, but you're the biological dad, the sperm donor, so to speak, but your rights as custodial parent had never been established. In fact, your legal status as the father had never been established because you weren't married to the mom, and the two of you didn't execute an affidavit of parentage, and there's no circuit court order judging you to be the father of the child. That's different. You'd have no legal... You would have no legal right to do anything, and then if you did that, it's false imprisonment. So if any of you guys in here are in this situation, you go down and get your parental rights established.
Even if the mom gave consent to you to ground the child? Say, like, if somebody's dating the mother, and the mother looks at you and says,
she can change her mind and revoke that consent.
I have a question. If you develop a reasonable
my son's
father, he signed the affidavit of parentage.
But
I'm there, it gave me full custody.
You both have to sign the affidavit of parentage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the new forms.
And it gave me full custody of my son, it says right in there that the mother had.
Until it's changed by a circuit court order. Yes, those are the new forms.
And we never ever went to court.
It used to be they didn't have that in there.
He never went to court. He has no established rights. Like, the judge hasn't given him
the decision. The judge doesn't have to give him rights. If the two of you executed an acknowledgement of paternity, that's in lieu of a circuit court order. You've established his legal rights as a dad. Then he's not going to be sued for false imprisonment. That's got nothing to do with who has custody, which is control of the child at a particular moment in time. That's going to depend on whether there's a circuit court order. Okay.
So, you just turned 18, because you have to have your parents away from your age. So, say you're 18, you move with your parents, and you do whatever, and you come home, and they take your phone away and they ground you.
They can't ground you because you have the right to leave.
So, if you leave, then...
You have the right to leave.
The only
false imprisonment is he wouldn't let you leave.
Because usually, like, I know when my parents, when I was grounded when I was 18, they said, you have two choices, be grounded and abide by the grounding rules, or when you leave, the only time you're ever coming back is to grab your stuff. And turning everything in that we ever bought you as far as, like, electronics.
They don't let you have your stuff?
Well, Yeah, that's what it says. When you come back, you get all your stuff that you actually bought, not what you
Conversion is exercising, this is more than what you might think it is, exercising control over property of another with intent to defraud. Very broad. It covers a lot of different situations. It covers basic stealing, but that's a different kind of behavior than we're going to talk about now. Stealing is just stealing, and everybody knows what that is. The intent is different. The intent is to permanently deprive the victim. But conversion goes beyond that and covers this situation. You borrow somebody else's property, and you make a conscious decision at some point in time that you're not going to give it back. At the moment you make that decision, and the other person wants it back, they didn't give you permission to keep it beyond the amount of time you were supposed to have. Once you make the conscious decision that this stuff, I'm not giving it back, I'm keeping it, and you don't have the permission by the true owner to have it any longer, then that's a civil tort of conversion. So back to this example, you're 18 and you're living there almost like a tenant or a roommate. You're not living there in the legal status of a child anymore. They won't let you have your stuff, and it's obviously your stuff.
Like
the cell phone that you bought. It's clothes that are your clothes. It's your jewelry or whatever. It's your purse. It's not anything that was shared with the parents, clearly. They won't let you have it. That's conversion, and you can sue them for conversion. By the way, we do have a conversion. Conversion is our essay question on the first test. A little advanced form. Involving a famous musical singer from my generation. Some of you in here will certainly know who that guy is. Okay, let's use an example we use from battery. We have somebody, another young lady that goes to sleep at night, not in a motel, but in a house, and the door locks from the outside, and somebody locks the door from the outside, and she's sleeping. But when she gets up in the morning, by that time, the door has been unlocked again. Was there false imprisonment? No. Because she didn't experience the fear of being confined. She never knew she was confined. Okay. Whereas with the battery, she knew that slime ball put his lips up to her face, that she did not want that to happen, and she now still has the fear because that was done to her. Whereas when she gets up and it's not locked, she never knows she was locked. Even if somebody told her that, they might not be telling her the truth, or she might not believe it. So, different situation. So you have to experience the fear from false imprisonment.
So only if she woke up in the middle of the night and figured out that the door was locked, would she false imprisonment?
Yes. If she couldn't get out. If she had no reasonable safe means of escape and chose not to, yes. Now, back to false imprisonment again. Store security. Michigan has a statute that says for retail store security that they have a right once they make a determination that they have probable cause to believe that somebody has committed a crime inside the store. It can be stealing, but it doesn't have to be. It could be maliciously destroying something inside the store. Either way, they have the right under that statute to take that person into custody and hold them for the police. That's rule number one. And as long as they had probable cause, which means more likely than not, more like the factual information they had told them based on their training and experience, that more likely than not, that person had taken some of the property in the store. If they could reach that conclusion, then they're privileged to place that person under arrest and hold them for the police. That's rule number one.
And if
it turns out they didn't have probable cause, just said, hey, that person looks like a thief. I'll bet you that if I grab that person and bring him back, I'll bet you we're going to find a CD in his pocket. No, can't be bad.
All right, so what if I'm walking out the store and that person sees me looking through the CDs and he's like, oh, I bet you see me hold one, put it down like this and pick up another one. And by the time he walked around the corner, I already put that CD back, so when he came back, there was nothing in my hand.
Again, factual development.
Well, what else
can you say? You have to develop the facts to make it clear that it's more likely than not
that person had taken that CD.
Well, what I was trying to get at, though, is at the end, though, they you know, put me in holding for the police, and the police get there, and they check all my stuff. I don't have nothing on the property. Can I turn around then and sue them for false imprisonment?
If you can prove that they did not have probable cause to believe you had stolen something from the store, yes. You're going to have a hard time finding a lawyer to take a case like that unless it's clearly and obviously you weren't stealing anything.
Yeah, I'm talking like after they checked you, like there's nothing on you, period. And there's
that,
no record of
you can't have anything. You can't have shoplifter profiling. Oh, this person has stolen in here before, I remember. And you just go grab them. No, you can't just go grab them. You have to watch them to the point where you can see what they call furtive movements. F-U-R-T-I-V-E. The furtive movements that it appears that they're stealing something. That's the same thing an officer has to look for inside of a car that he's behind. Furtive gestures to establish reasonable cause to stop the car. Somebody had a point over here.
I work in retail, and even
are you security?
No, I'm just a regular associate.
The same rule applies to you.
Well, even in our store or chain or whatever, you cannot. If you're not a manager or management, you cannot stop the person. You have to go find a manager.
That's a store policy, though.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a store. Stores can have their own policy. Some stores say that they're not going to prosecute if they just get the thing back and they get the money back. By the way, retail fraud can occur before you even get past the checkout. Retail fraud is a criminal offense. Any taking, grabbing of somebody else's property with the intent to permanently deprive the victim of it is retail fraud in the state of Michigan. Any movement. So I can walk from the produce area and I can walk over to an area near the checkout, put it down on a table and walk out. If I had the intent to steal when I moved that, I already committed the crime. But many stores, just because of the hassle and the number of cases, as a matter of policy, won't deal with a situation like that.
Because I know so many times that I was walking through a store, picked up a CD, didn't know I was going to buy it, get to the checkout, look at it, and go, you know what, I don't want to spend $20, and set it down, and just walk out.
Rule number two. Citizen's arrest. The reason why I spelled that rule out for store security is because some retail fraud type thefts are misdemeanors. If it's $0 to $200, or if the person doesn't have a prior felony, a prior retail fraud conviction, to misdemeanor. Citizen's arrest rule only applies to felonies. And some retail frauds are felonies. Retail fraud first degree, over $1,000, or a second degree, $200 to $1,000, in which the person's got a prior conviction for that, makes it a first degree felony. So for felony, any citizen, any of us in here, if a felony has been committed in our presence, we have the right to arrest that person and take them to the police. I'm not necessarily recommending it because you may get hurt, but you have the right to do it.
If you were to do something like that, are there things that you have to read in their rights, or do you have to...
No. In fact, store security doesn't have to read rights because the Fourth Amendment only applies to government. Government intrusion of people's private lives, their privacy, and bodily freedom. When government tries to stop that, government must do that. Private citizens don't, and store security doesn't have to read any Miranda rights or anything. They don't have to do that. You don't have to do it. You have the right to take them. You can't be sued successfully for false imprisonment as long as you had probable cause to believe they had committed a felony more than probable cause. An officer only needs probable cause. For you, you must have seen the felony take place, you must have been in your presence, and then you have the right to arrest them.
So, since the security guards don't have to read you your rights, could they get away with like throwing you up against the wall and reaching into your pockets and yanking out whatever's in your pocket?
Or in the words of the old Jerry Jeff Walker song, it's up against the wall, redneck mother.
So, yeah.
Anybody here know who Jerry Jeff Walker is?
No. I'm guessing before my time.
I'll find one of these songs, one of these days, somebody's going to know. Like Tim Hart, The Lady Came from Baltimore, maybe? Yeah. All right, where were we before I got silly here? Sometimes I get silly.
The rights of a store to hold you don't give them a right to search you, do they? They can just detain you for the police.
Yeah, but if they can't find that the store's property on you, then they're gonna have a problem. So if they have reasonable cause to believe that their merchandise is in your pocket, then they have the right to retrieve the merchandise out of the pocket.
Okay, so they do.
They have the right to do a full body search and a body cavity search? Hell no.
So if they see a bulge in my pocket, they have the right to empty that one pocket out.
Right. Yeah. They have the right to take your shoes off and empty your socks and any of that kind of stuff. No. Unless the facts that they base their probable cause on go to what might be in your shoe. They can say, he was taking his shoes off and putting stuff in his shoe. So yes. And so I took his shoe off to get the merchandise. Yeah, you're okay with that.
All right, so it's basically what they see and as far as what they see.
Yep. That's got to be what it is. It's got to be what they see.
Can they handcuff you? Or lock you in a room?
Yep. For 3 days? No. And the duty to immediately contact law enforcement. But yes, they can hold the person until, as long as they made a reasonable attempt to get law enforcement there, they can do that. Now, some places just have a policy of not doing it. They just won't. If it's Sears, not Sears, because I dealt with Sears loss prevention in a case in court. Maybe it's Myers?
I know Best
Buy. One of these stores has a policy, we won't chase them into the parking lot.
Yeah, it's Best Buy. I know Best Buy.
Maybe Best Buy.
We
may go out and get the plate, but we're not going to try to physically.
I know Best Buy. Those people at the door of the security professionals. If you can get a passing TV, that's just, if you can get it past them without them, you know, taking you out. As long as if you can make it through the whole set doors and step foot in the parking lot, they will not pursue you and try to chase you down.
Right. So back to conversion. Now tonight, when everybody gets home tonight, I want you to go in your closets. I want you to go out in your basement. I want you to go in your garage and see if you can find somebody else's property that you forgot to give back. Actually, that actually happened to me. A few years ago, I was teaching this. You know, I start thinking, don't like stealing out that tuxedo from the Midland Music Corral that I used to be a member of. But they practice on Monday nights. That's why I don't do that anymore. I'd rather teach here than sing in the Music Corral in Midland. So I went back, and at the very end of my closet, right next to the wall, there it was. I took it back. I had that thing in my closet for a couple of years.
There was really
got somebody else's property, give it the hell back to them.
So wait a minute. If your parents buy something for you, you're a teenager.
That's a gift. That's a gift. What's your gift?
Anyway.
Gift law is when you have the, and we're going to get to this when we get to contracts. And wait till you find out what the law is on diamond engagement rings. Wait till you hear about that one. The gift law, once you make the intention to give somebody a gift and coupled with physical transfer of that gift and receipt of that gift, the gift is complete and it's not the giver's anymore.
What
gift
is the writing that it don't belong to the person?
You can loan somebody something. I use that example up here. You loan somebody something, then they made a decision, the one that borrowed it made a decision not to give it back. And when they made that decision, they've converted it, and they're liable for it now.
Okay. One more question. When my aunt was younger, my grandmother didn't want her moving out. She was ready. So they had a car in both of their names. It was my aunt's car, and my grandma's name was on it for insurance purposes and whatever, for the insurance she did. Anyway, my grandma to keep her from moving out would tell her that if she moved out, she'd take her car from her.
If you move out, I'm going to take your car from you. Whose car was it?
Well, it was in both of their names, so legally it was both of their car, but it was my aunt was the one.
Then she can't. Then she can't. She could take the car if she wanted to take the car. So whoever's got the car has got the car because it's got both names on it. Right? The same problem occurs, and I always give particularly the ladies that come into my law office. I give them this speech. You don't go living with some guy for 3, 4, 5 years. You're crazy. That relationship doesn't ripen into a marriage. And by the way, for long periods of long cohabitation that then become marriage, about a 90% divorce rate. If that situation does not become a marriage, you're going to lose that stuff, whatever you have. You're going to lose that money in the bank. Because then you're saying, you guys hate hearing me say this. The guy's usually the power in a relationship, and when you break up, he's going to take the stuff.
Some of it's being been paid for by your money, but he's going to get it.
Isn't there
another? And then what are you going to do? Try to file a lawsuit? Law does not, Michigan does not recognize a cohabitation relationship. And so you gain no rights, legal rights, because you were in a cohabitation relationship. Then, if you don't still have that receipt to prove that you paid for it with your money, you ain't getting anything. So don't do that.
Isn't it?
Keep everything separate.
Isn't it 30 days after living with each other? Because I don't know about the property, but when I tried
throwing
my father out, you know,
pregnant, you're not
going to
marry the guy.
That he could,
don't put yourself at risk.
If I locked him out, he'd legally break the window. We could use sales residence in there after living there for 30 days. Even though his name was not on the lease, and he was.
Now you're getting into landlord-tenant law. Whole different. We're going to get to landlord-tenant later in the semester.
Can it be the other way around, where the girl's going to take all the stuff? She buys it? Is it always going to be the guy that's taking the stuff?
About 80% of the time, it's been my experience practicing law for 28 years, about 80% of the time, the guy gets most of the stuff.
Really?
Yes.
Why? Because he's the one that pays for it all?
Because his view of the relationship and the purpose of the relationship was different than hers was. And I don't want to get too much into that.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I can't remember who told me this, and I can't remember if it's even Michigan, but somebody said that there is a law where if you guys lived up to 3 years together, that...
Well, common law marriage was Michigan eliminated in 1956.
So it's not Michigan?
Alright. In common law, a long period of cohabitation, at least 5 years, when you held yourself out as if you were husband and wife to the community, called each other husband and wife, told other people you were... that's a common law marriage. In common law, you're presumed to be married. Michigan eliminated that in 1950.
All right, so the whole splitting everything like it's 50s for dating.
We don't have that in Michigan, do we? All
right.
However, under the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution, if you had achieved a common law marriage status in another state and then moved to Michigan, Michigan has to recognize it, which is going to be very interesting, but we're going to see some cases when same-gender marriage couples move into Michigan and then try to have that full faith and credit established. I'm not so sure any Michigan court would actually do that.
Let's
see what happens there.
All right, you said same-sex marriage. What if, like, two best friends lived together for, like, 10 years in the same house? Would that stuff be, like,
best
brothers
friends?
Or whatever? Yeah.
There is no common law same-gender marriage.
All right, awesome. I just didn't know.
We're talking about in the 1500s from England, I'm sure they didn't think of such a thing there. Okay. But you raised a very good question, and I'm glad you did that. Where are we next? I haven't even looked at the chapter yet. I'm sure there's some stuff there. Intentional infliction of emotional distress on page 192, Michigan really doesn't recognize this anymore. There hasn't been a successful discussion of that in a long, long time. So you're not responsible for that. Invasion of privacy is next. At 7:40, if somebody would let me alert me for that, I'd appreciate it. Invasion of privacy is in court frequently of the rich and famous. Anyway, anybody watch those awful Golden Globe Awards last night?
No.
Hollywood people are so arrogant. Four different kinds of invasion of privacy developed in common law in England. Basically, somebody has violated your privacy rights in a particular way, before on the border, giving you the right to sue them for damages. Private physical intrusion that is unreasonable to the person. This is the Peeping Tom. This is the guy that climbs up to the very top of his tree, hangs for dear life on the tallest branches of his tree with a high-powered lens, so he can watch the lady next door sunbathe in the nude where she thought nobody could see.
unreasonable intrusion. That means that he went way beyond what you would expect anybody to do to try to penetrate somebody's zone of privacy. On the other hand, if she's just walking around inside of her house in the nude, and she doesn't have any curtains, he decides he doesn't want to have any curtains either, and he just manages to be walking around in his own house, kind of looking through and kind of liking that, that's an intrusion, but it's not an unreasonable intrusion, because she's taking those steps to make sure that doesn't happen, which she could do by having those curtains. But she goes to her backyard, and she sets up this area. It's like a tall fence, and not one of those fences you can see through either. You can't see through the fence, and it's tall, and she is all around her property, and she thinks there's nobody except the birds that are going to be able to watch her. And so she's out there, and not way out to the end of the property, but close in by her house. And real hard to see, unless you're at the very top of that tree. But he goes. He's committed a private, physical, unreasonable intrusion. That's invasion of privacy, number one. Okay, in fact, that's, I didn't even look at the book here, and that's the same one they use as number one. So we'll go in the order that they're going in. Two, public disclosure of private facts. By the way, we had a multiple choice question on the first test on this one here. I don't know if you want to put a star on your notes by that. We have a right to maintain some things about us as private. We have HIPAA laws, which means that our medical records are supposed to be private. Our sexual preferences, our weird games maybe that we like to play with our friends on Saturday night. How many times us older guys have to get up at the night and go to the bathroom? A lot of this is common sense on what you think would be the kind of fact we wouldn't want anybody else to know. Whether or not you had a sexually transmitted disease. Whether or not you were convicted for indecent exposure. Some private fact about yourself that you wouldn't tell anybody, except maybe your closest, most intimate friends.
How can a conviction be private information when it's on your public record?
Because people don't go down and look at records. Very few people do. The person went down and saw it in the public record, it'd be no problem. But for somebody else that has knowledge of that fact, telling somebody who doesn't have knowledge of that fact, that's probably a public disclosure of a private fact.
How does that guy get away with that magazine that comes out?
Mugshot magazine?
Mugshot magazine. How does he get away with that?
What does he do?
Puts down on the courthouses, gets pictures and facts on cases, puts it all in.
Not just people that are on the sex offender registry, anybody, right? Anybody that's got a criminal record?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. Mostly sex.
Probably because nobody has sued him yet. Somebody probably will sue him.
Well, what about...
And that'll be tested. That's kind of close to the line there.
What about the Midland Daily News when they put, you know, so-and-so, you know, got arrested for blah, blah, blah in the back pages?
They don't.
Yes, they do.
No. They don't.
They might not do it in the crime law.
Here's what they do.
So, like, what if you go to trial?
Not arrested. Arraigned. Charged. Yes. They will not do it just based on an arrest. The newspapers are smart. Because an arrest doesn't mean anything. Because the prosecutor decides whether or not there's going to be a charge, not the officer. Okay? Sometimes get the wrong guy, or the prosecutor decides he isn't going to charge him. And if the prosecutor decided he wasn't going to charge him, now we would have a problem. We would have an invasion of privacy lawsuit. So once they've seen a judge, which is within 48 hours of the arrest, and get arraigned, yeah, then they put that in.
You said if you're charged with something, people aren't allowed to talk about it. Or it's an invasion of your privacy.
Well, what you said was that, like,
you didn't hear it right.
If I got a thing on his record and say he went down to the public courthouse is what the way I understood you, and he's like, oh, well, that's awesome. He got arrested 4 years ago. Now he's my neighbor, and closes it up, and then he goes to the other neighbor on the other side. I'd say her that doesn't have no any idea. And you said that if he told her, that's public disclosure of my private fact because he told her and she didn't know, and even though he found out the right way. Wouldn't that be the same?
What I said earlier was, is if there was a conviction, not somebody did something and somebody got arrested, if there was a conviction. Although that's not an obvious example as some of these other facts, but it might actually, if that person never would have looked it up, wouldn't even know how to look it up, was told this, that could constitute public disclosure or private fact. So, I mean, it's a matter of common sense as far as wet facts. I think we all can kind of decide that for ourselves that are just too personal, and you wouldn't tell anybody or knows that you would. If it's a public disclosure, that private fact. If you disclosed it yourself, obviously you can't be sued because somebody else did. Because although you have a right of privacy, you can waive that right of privacy if you want to. Just like the spousal communication privilege. A communication between a husband and a wife is privileged. I mean, it's private. The purpose of this privilege is to support the marital relationship whenever possible, a mission that's part of Republican policy. So you can't use a statement between a husband and a wife in court. If that statement was intended to be private, if they didn't make the statement in a way in which it was intended to be private, then the privilege doesn't apply. So the husband and wife were bickering in a bar, yelling at each other in a bar, that's not the spousal communication privilege because everybody's listening to it. And more on that later. Okay, we got two more. False light invasion of privacy. Inland Daily News would be a good one to bring in here for this example. Somebody caused you to have publicity about something that you were doing to make it appear as if you were doing something at work. Make it appear as if there was some embarrassing thing you were doing when you weren't doing that at all. Like your picture appears in the paper, and there's a statement underneath the caption that makes it sound like you're committing a criminal act when in fact you were just on the scene. False light. You were publicly portrayed, something you did. You didn't cause yourself any publicity. You're not the one that went out and held the press conference. Somebody else caused you to have publicity about something you were doing to make it appear as if you were doing something other than what you were. I'd like to give an example. Jay Brando, guy I know from TV5, for a long, long time reporter here. He's out doing an expose on drug dealing at Delta College. Yes, and there are reports that this man about 50, I guess that would be me, selling drugs out of a brown bag in the parking lot of the Midland campus of Delta College. A lot of people are concerned about it. And he's interviewing somebody, and just then, I get out of my car, and I'm walking in to teach my class, and I have stuff in a brown bag. And the camera shows me, Jay Randall turns and looks. Can you imagine how bold they could be right in front of the TV camera? Okay. Jay Randall, TV5, then vicariously would be liable, because he's acting within the scope of his employment. Both Jay Randall and TV5 then portrayed me publicly in a false light.
The book we talked about for defamation, the media has a qualified exception. That doesn't apply here at all?
Defamation's the next tort.
Right. Okay. So
that's coming up quickly here.
Okay.
And there's some overlap. That's as you raised that. There's some overlap between invasion of privacy, as we're going to see, in defamation. One more. Anybody know what the fourth one is? This one has a tort of the rich and famous. Appropriation. When, I'm not going to misspell a word like last week. When somebody uses another person, usually a celebrity, either their likeness or their name, for commercial reasons to help sell a product or a service without their permission, that's invasion of privacy. It's really almost like an intellectual property right, actually. The fact that your name and your likeness could sell products
means you can make money just because you're famous and you're a celebrity. Now, this only applies when the person is alive. That's why the ancestors of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln cannot sue people every time there's a President's Day sale. And you see caricatures of President Lincoln and President Washington in these commercials. Because appropriation only applies when the person is alive. You lose your publicity value, intellectual property right, because you're famous the moment you die. So you got to get their permission. Remember those billboards for that cell phone company that no longer exists? I think it was Altel. And what they would do is they put a picture or a name of a famous person that's endorsing the cell phone. Have you remember those billboards? They used to be around here. But it was the name of a local person that just happened to have the same name.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Is that appropriation?
Yes.
That's funny.
Yes.
George Foreman was one I remember.
There
was a local guy named George Foreman who was, for those of you that don't know, was a famous boxer, heavyweight champion.
They're still trying to use George Foreman's name and notoriety, even if they don't use his image, to sell their product.
So, and their argument is going to be, no, all we're saying here is that George Foreman of Saginaw, Michigan, is endorsing her product. He likes it, so you should too. That's all we're saying.
A reasonable person would know what they meant.
It's clever.
If the billboard, does the billboard have any kind of, like, disclaimer at the bottom of it or anything like
that? Yeah, but since it's fine print, you can't read it driving around the car.
You probably...
How many of us park our car and get up and climb on top of the billboard to look at that language?
You probably couldn't find any billboards with people who didn't just happen to be named the same as a celebrity, which would indicate or would help establish that they were attempting to capitalize upon the celebrity's name.
Does Chapter 9 have that Here's Johnny toilet case? We'll get to it. Yeah, I mean, these are the four forms of invasion of privacy. They take, maybe this version of the book took that problem out. That used to be in here. Is that not in here?
I don't remember.
Here's Johnny.
Does the appropriate form only involve selling the product?
Yes.
So what you're saying
is... It could be a service, it could be a product.
But it's selling something.
Well,
so
selling, not necessarily monetary gain, but some, you have to prove some kind of benefit from the endorsement of the product, because it could be like a non-profit corporation or something.
So you're saying if the person's dead, that doesn't apply.
Right.
So
you can't sue from the grave.
Altel could have put, George Washington approves our phone, and
yes,
they can do nothing.
That's
not
right.
Even a relative of George Washington?
Retail stores, and we're about to get those commercials because we're coming up on the President's Day, so we're going to be seeing those commercials every year. Not appropriation because of that. There was a real case. Anybody here old enough like me to remember Johnny Carson, host of The Tonight Show? He was introduced every night by Ed McMahon. Here's Johnny. Remember that? Well, this guy's name was... He started a company, his name was John Carson, and he started a toilet company, manufactured toilets. And so the name of it, his company was Here's Johnny, John for toilet. Okay. Johnny Carson sued him. This is when Johnny Carson was still host of The Tonight Show, which he was host of The Tonight Show from 1962 to May of 1991 when Jay Leno.
But wouldn't, like, the phrase Here's Johnny be copyrighted or TM'd or something like that? Wouldn't the phrase Here's Johnny by The Tonight Show be TM'd or copyrighted?
It was not.
Because I
but
know...
It was not at the time, but their argument was Here's Johnny was so associated with his program that by calling it that, he was trying to imply that Johnny Carson was endorsing his product.
Because I know the Air Force...
Johnny Carson won the lawsuit, by the way.
Because I know the Air Force went over to Larry the Cable Guy. Because I don't think Larry the Cable Guy, I'm not sure at the time, had his get her done phrase TM'd or copyrighted.
Pass their time here. Take a break. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Sorry, guys.
Pass their time.